If you're haunted and harassed by your own inner critic, if you've ever been curious about why hypnosis works so well, if you're a seasoned hypnotist, or if you suspect that the inner critic is actually hypnotizing you to hold back from reaching the greatness that you know deep down is inside you, lean in and get inspired to get out of your comfort zone and create your one precious life with purpose and intention. If you like this show, you'll love my powerful hypnosis audio, The Answer Room, because it gives you crystal clear guidance and direction and illuminates an ingenious way to make triumphant decisions, no matter how stuck you feel or how confused you were. This powerful hypnosis audio is my gift to you when you go to theimpostermonster.com. Again, that's theimpostermonster.com. Don't forget the. Theimpostermonster.com. And yes, I'm done saying it. Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for listening. I'm Lori Hammond, and I'm truly grateful for you.
Welcome. You are in for such a treat. This conversation is a masterclass in personal transformation, and I'm so grateful to have my teacher, Mike Mandel, here today. Mike's career has covered many different fields: stage performer, hypnosis trainer, martial arts instructor, writer, and corporate speaker. Mike's wit and imagination make him a natural entertainer. Mike teaches his Neo-Ericksonian hypnosis approach online and in person in Toronto when we're not in the middle of a pandemic. The Mike Mandel Hypnosis Academy is widely regarded as one of the top hypnosis trainings in the world. I found Mike Mandel and his business partner, Chris Thompson, through their podcast, Brain Software. After listening to their entertaining banner for a couple of years, I somewhat spontaneously signed up for the Mike Mandel Hypnosis Academy. And I believe it's one of the smartest, most life-changing decisions I have ever made. I'm so happy to welcome my dear friend and teacher, Mike Mandel, to today's show.
Mike, thank you so much for being here. This is my most anticipated interview. I'm so, so grateful for you. This is like the pinnacle of my career to have my teacher and mentor on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
You are much too kind. You really are.
So
every time I talk to you, I have to cut all the doorways in our house like keyholes so I can get my head out.
Well, I was just sharing before we hopped on the call that you have changed my life in so many ways. And before I met you, I was terrified of hypnosis. I thought that it was mind control. I was not allowed to watch Scooby-Doo as a little girl because it had hypnosis in it. I wasn't allowed to watch the Smurfs because there was magic in it. And so when I found your Brain Software podcast with you and Chris, and I remember listening to you and Chris talk about pranking the waitresses and doing all these ridiculous things and just how easy it is to start to shift people's ideologies and people, the way they show up in the world with hypnosis. And I remember thinking, do they actually, like, who are they fooling? There's no way it can be this easy. And as I've learned from you and as I've started to practice these things myself, I realized, you know, there's a reason people think hypnosis is magic, because it works so incredibly well. So
yeah, it really does, doesn't it? It's a remarkable thing. And I always say the mind is my favorite toy. And likewise, Lori, the whole mythology about hypnosis, I never had any problem growing up with it. I mean, I started doing it in 1965 when I was 12 and found out I had a knack for it and messed with it for 10 years. And then it became a job in 1975. So for me, it's now full-time for 46 years. And this, but I went through a phase where the church where we were attending, people would hand me stacks of paper, they printed off the internet. Everything's like hypnosis, threat or menace. It's like, talk about a double bind. And it's well-intended people who just have no understanding of the science behind it. No understanding that now we know the science to a large degree. We're dealing with neurology. We're dealing with the brain. We're not dealing with the spirit.
I had no intention of going here when we jumped on, but since we're already steering that way, would you just share a little bit about, you know, for anyone who's listening, who maybe feels like there's a conflict between faith and hypnosis, could you offer some perspective on that?
Oh, sure. And it's, you know, I'm unashamedly a Bible believing Christian. I have been for many years. I came out of a very dark place. And to me, it's part of the wonder of how we are created, that we have a trillion neurons inside our head, and they're putting together neural pathways at the rate of a million per second on average. That is a remarkable degree of complexity that demands an infinitely powerful mind to create that. And to me, hypnosis is a wonderful tool. In fact, the church we currently go to, our pastor had since passed away. He was from India, but he was a Fulbright scholar. He pastored a church in Washington, D.C., and a wonderful man, brilliant man. And when he met me, I showed up at the church and I had, you know, shorts, some big shorts, some Blundstone steel-toed shoes, and covered in tattoos. My head buzzed. I looked like an aging skinhead. And he said, so what do you do, Mike? I said, I'm a hypnotist. And I just waited for the usual explosion. And he said, oh, that's wonderful. You must be able to help a lot of people. And I thought, thank you. Somebody gets it, you know? Yes. But so we're back to Terry Steele, you know, there's no such thing as hypnosis. Everything's hypnosis. If we stop thinking of it in terms of some degree of control mechanism and start thinking of it in terms of information processing and how our wonderful brains are designed, and I do mean designed, then it makes a lot more sense. And people typically, you know, Lori, people do not have a problem with hypnosis. They really don't. They have a problem with what they believe hypnosis is.
Right.
And that's the real difficulty. I find if we can educate people, we can largely bring them out of that darkness into something a little lighter.
I love that. Mike, when we got on this call, I explained that some crazy things have happened, and this might be a fun place to segue just because it's front of my mind, if it's all right with you.
Sure.
My favorite thing that I have learned from you. So I came to hypnosis because I had struggled with my weight my entire life. And when I learned hypnosis, the unexpected side effect was that it wiped out decades of depression for me.
Wow.
And what's underneath that is me understanding that I can change my state, that I can change who I am being in the world, that I can change the way I'm showing up in the world. And this is all what I've learned from you through talking about ego states. And I think that this topic can really apply nicely to the idea of imposter syndrome and the people who struggle with feeling like they're like, what if I'm not good enough? What if I'm not ready? What if? So if you would just talk a little bit about ego states, and for the listener, be listening as Mike speaks for ways that you can apply this to the context of dealing with that inner critic and stepping into your power to make a difference in the world.
Excellent. It's, you know, ego states are a fascination of mine. I went through a phase where I started thinking, good grief. I did a lot of therapy when I was a full-time therapist in the 1990s in Toronto. And I started to draw the conclusion, it seems to be ego states are the problem or what we need to deal with a lot of the time. And then I realized I was wrong. It isn't a lot of the time, it's all the time. It's always, every single time I can prove it's about ego states. And you've alluded to the idea of us having sub-personalities. We typically use the same 5 to 15 every day, although we have anywhere from 50 to 150. The best model for understanding them is realizing they are digital. You can't have two running the show at once. The stronger one will win. But when I say digital, only one will be executive. And by executive, I mean that one of them is connected to your prefrontal cortex. And that's the one, when you say I and point at yourself, you're pointing to the ego state that's currently executive. Now, when we think of it, the best model I've ever seen, I used to use the classroom model, but I much prefer the bungalow model. We think of a bungalow, single floor, but with only one door, no escape, no, you know, fire exit, one door. And you have your 5 to 15 daily ego states you use all the time on that main floor. And they know about each other and they talk to each other and they largely get along. And whenever there's something in life to deal with, like a conversation or a task that needs to be done, the front door opens and one of those ego states answers the door. And that's the one that's executive. Now in the basement, we have the rec room that North Americans have so often, especially here in Canada. We practically live down there with the fireplace in the winter. And down there, we have the remaining ego states. Some of them venture upstairs from time to time and become executive. By and large, they're content to stay down there and hang out together. They may not all get along with each other. Some of them might actually hate each other, but this can all be negotiated. But there's also off to the side, the bomb shelter. And the bomb shelter contains traumatized ego states. They're invaded, as Gordon Emerson said. So we say vated for short. Vated ego states are not healthy, and they're invaded by fear, anger, sadness, and trauma. And they need healing. They need to be understood and healed. When they're healed, they're brought back into the community. When they're back in the community, they're happy and they can have a useful task. And you said the inner critic, that's really interesting. As a graphologist and a forensic graphologist, working on many crimes over the years, one of the things I see again and again in handwriting is when someone does the T bar of the small letter T, if they do it from right to left instead of left to right, particularly if it finishes with a sharp point, that is willpower directed against self. And whenever I see that, I know the person has an inner critical voice that becomes executive a lot of the time. And they would always say the same thing to me. They'd say, what is my writing show? I'd say, well, you've got an inner voice that criticizes you all the time. And they always say, well, everyone does. I say, I don't. My problems mean the opposite. I've got an inner voice saying, yeah, go do it, like urging me to do all the wrong stuff. But even these things will show up. And an inner critic is only useful in some contexts. It's not useful to run our lives, and very often it's a parental voice if we listen to it carefully. And it's one of the many ways that ego states can manifest. And the more we can make friends with our ego states, the more we can help them build bridges to each other, recognizing that when we do, they are actually building neural pathways to each other. So we're getting neurological pathways in the brain with the ones who are connected. I believe the more integrated, quote unquote, we are as human beings, the more our ego states know about each other and have communication with each other. When someone is dissociative identity disorder, formerly called MPD, they'll have blackouts and so on. And it's not like they have ego states and we don't. I mean, it's normal to have ego states, we have them. But a lot of theirs don't have clear lines of communication. And because of trauma, because of vated ego states that are invaded by fear, anger, sadness, and trauma, when they become executive, there will not be a clear communication line to the other states. So if you or I, Lori, go into a kitchen, stand in front of a fridge for 30 seconds and go, what the heck did I just come in here for? That's normal. But if you find yourself standing there and you can't remember the last 2 hours, that's not normal. And that's the sort of thing we'll see with dissociative identity disorder. They're literally dissociated and disconnected from each other. And so for the average person, they learn to use the right ego state for the job. And that's the key. They like having a job. They like doing different things. And what I'll do, Lori, if you like, at the end of this, I'll give you a link to my, it's only 2 pages. It's a short form ego state integration protocol. For people who are watching or listening, who are professional therapists, will find this very useful. I came up with this about 7 years ago. The idea is, we want the right one for the job to be executive. And that's not always the case. When I play with my Egyptian male cat, that's not the ego state I want to be executive when I'm teaching jiu-jitsu. You know, I don't want to be locking someone up and going, oh, it's probably stupid and weird. Likewise, you want the right one for the job as often as we can. And I have negotiated with mine. I've done quite a lot of self-work over the years. And one of the things is I have an ego state. It is my ultimately most resourceful ego state. I call it my 007 or my James Bond ego state. And I've negotiated with him that when the chips are down and I have what has to be a life-threatening emergency to me or someone nearby, he takes the executive immediately without permission, runs this program, whatever he has to do to fix things, and then exits again right away. He's only had to do it once, but the results were startling. My wife and I run Highway 401 going through the north end of Toronto, which people are surprised. It's the busiest stretch of highway in North America. It's 16 lanes wide through the city. And so we're flying along the highway at highway speed. And in front of me was a pickup truck. And he didn't have the, you know, the thing at the, what do you call it, that falls down. It's supposed to hold things in. He didn't have it in position. And he had a dresser in the back of this.
Oh.
And this dresser slid out on the highway. And I was doing 70 miles an hour, and this thing is in front of me, 75 feet away. And this state instantly took the executive. I have the music in my head. Invasive driving around this thing. Missed it. My wife said, that was pretty impressive driving. And I went, my heart rate wasn't even elevated. There wasn't even any adrenaline. So if you got an emergency, he's the one you want around. Now, he's only going to show up when he has to, though. But the wonderful thing is, as hypnotists, we can communicate with our own ego states, and we can change them. I've had a remarkable thing with a new therapy I'm using. I just debuted it with five of my students online, and now they're using it, having these amazing results. I call it ego state transformation. I discovered by accident that when we envision an ego state, its appearance will and its name will tell us its nature, what it does. And I had an ego state that, for anyone familiar with the Enneagram, my wife is a six. Sixes are extremely dutiful, loyal, salt of the earth, but they have a lot of what if, like anxieties about what if things go wrong. And I'm Enneagram type eight. We're the white knights. We want to protect women and children and furry animals. When we're good, we're really good. We're the ones who go into burning buildings and stuff and kill terrorists. But when we're bad, we're the mass murderers. It's a bad thing. So the key is to be integrated. Well, in her case, sometimes I would just say something. Oh, by the way, did you hear that Chris told me this? And right away, my brain's going, oh, I know she's going to take that the wrong way. Well, you know, does Chris think there's a problem? Isn't the business going well? And I'm like, okay, you know what I mean? Just a random thing. Right after I've said it, I thought it was a mistake. So one day I sat down, put myself in a trance, and I said, I want to communicate with that ego state that says these things. Instantly, I saw it. It was kind of unshaven. It had an enormous head, but the head was shaped like a teardrop, and most of it was mouth. And on top, the brain was tiny, 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 and the ears were tiny. And I asked, I said, what is your name or your nature? It said blurter. It likes to just blurt things out. And I said, what is your intention in that? I want to talk about interesting things and bring them into the conversation. So I asked it not to do this anymore. But it, okay, kept happening. I'm thinking, well, I can't believe what I just said. So I realized the ears were small. It wasn't listening. Its brain was small. It couldn't get its head around. So I communicated again back in a trance. And I said, blurter, you've got to negotiate with them from a position of acceptance and kindness. You can't be mad. I said, you're doing a great job. Would you like to do an even better job at talking about stuff? Yeah. So I said, what I'd like to do is make you even smarter than you are. Would that be cool? So I said, we make your brain pan larger. Why don't we make your mouth a little bit smaller so it's in proportion? You look even more handsome. Now we're going to make your ears larger so you'll hear the things I say to you. Okay, so we do this. He's agreed to the changes. Immediately, I notice there's a difference. Even though it's still not happening as often, it's still happening. So I gave him permission to keep transforming. And then I touched base, as crazy as this sounds, I touched base a couple of weeks later. Now, he's this good-looking guy. He looks like a corporate lawyer. Now he's got an Armani suit. He's got a briefcase. And he's got a laptop. And when I tell him something, he's got his laptop out with his portable desk. He's taking notes. He's starting to figure out the algorithm of what he should say and what he shouldn't. And now he's changed his name. He calls himself Presenter. Because what he does now is when he finds something interesting to talk about, he knows intuitively from what he's learned if it's good or not. He says it in my head first. And I say, yeah, great idea. And then he brings it into the conversation. So I told my students, the presentation, its name and its appearance will tell you its nature. If we change its appearance, and I know you know mindscaping, we change the metaphor, everything changes. Yes. Likewise, when we congruently and lovingly change the appearance of an ego state, its nature, everything changes. One of my students posted online, he contacted an ego state that was wounded. He said it sat across from him in a chair. He used the two chair method that Gestalt therapy used, which of course is all ego states. And he said the guy looked like a street person. He had bad skin, his eyes were watering, and he just worked to bring healing to this ego state. He said it was like the picture of Dorian Gray. And he even posted two pictures online. He said, this is what he used to look like, and this is what he looks like now. And he said he took a day, I think he said, just crying over this, relieved of how he had helped this part of himself. It's him. He's helped himself by doing this. So it's a remarkable field. And it absolutely blows my mind.
It's so beautiful. Already just in the first few minutes, you have given such massive value. Mike, will you go through a hypothetical with me? If let's say the person listening, it has emailed me last week and said, Lori, I really want to do what you're doing. I see you making a big difference. I've been through MMHA, which is Mike Mandel Hypnosis Academy. I have my certification, but I just need to get three more certifications before I actually start helping people. Or, you know, I'm so afraid that I'm going to get in there and I'm going to get the protocol wrong, or I'm not going to know how to help them, or it's not going to work. If you think about the ego state that is in the executive when they're writing me this email and they're feeling this insecurity, how would you coach them through this process?
To take great, action. Great question. First of all, I can think of a lot of different ways of doing this right away. I could do it through timeline and take them back to when they made that decision about something, remake the decision, have it echo into the future, you know, that I'm competent, whatever. I could treat this by asking, we'll get to ego states with this, but I could treat this by asking, what is their evidence criteria? How do you know you're uncertain about something? And how do you know when you have certainty? How do you know when you're competent? How would that be? And I used to think that for me, being competent meant when I saw certificates. And I had certificates in everything from graphology to hypnosis, all these different things. And then one day I asked myself, how do I know I'm competent in something? And because I'm a highly auditory person, it's my most powerful sense, obviously not visual. I mean, look what I'm wearing, but auditory. If I hear a song once, people think I'm crazy. If I hear a piece of music once and it affects me emotionally, I can remember it for the rest of my life. Wow. I mean, 50 years later, I'll hear it and I'll know exactly what it was and when I heard it. But that's the auditory sense. So for me, my evidence criteria for competence is I have to hear it. Someone tells me I've done a good job. Someone says that was excellent. Or I hear applause if I speak, that sort of thing. So when I discovered this, I went through my filing cabinet over there. I got all my certificates, just shredded them, threw them out. I just realized they were largely irrelevant. I had six awards. They're in a cupboard somewhere. They don't matter to me because I know I have my competency without having to see that external thing. Now, this person will have a way of knowing that she's competent. And you can ask her, is this something you see, something you hear, or is it an internal feeling, an internal check? It will be one of these. But then you can say, that part of you that is unconfident, how would you like it if it's not your job to be confident? We find another part of you that's really confident about something. Tell me, what are you most confident of in your life? Well, you know, I'm confident that my husband loves me. Okay, so when you think of that, is it something you hear? Is it, well, when I say to myself, he loves me, I feel this feeling inside. Okay, now I've gotten to a feeling point with this person now. As soon as the person is feeling it, that ego state is executive.
Okay.
That's the key. When they feel it in themselves, you now have that ego state executive. And now you can negotiate and say, that part of you that isn't confident, this isn't your job. It's not your job to be confident. It's your job to do something else. Let's find something you'd like to do instead. And the part of you that's confident, will you take on this new job of being really confident about how much you know about hypnosis too? Sure, I will. I'm good at that. Bang, there you go. It may be literally as simple as that, putting the right ego state for the job. And when it's the wrong one, it can be a nightmare. I had a hypnosis show back when I was doing those. I retired next month, this 3 years ago, after many, many years on the road, 5,000 shows in three continents. And I just got sick of it, got sick of my own voice on stage. But I had a show east of Toronto in Cobourg, Ontario. In a hall there, nice show, went okay, you know, I was happy with it. And a friend of my wife said, oh, it was a good show, but, and I, what? She said, Mike wasn't very entertaining. She said he was teaching rather than being entertaining. She was right. I had just been teaching 5-day architecture of hypnosis courses at University of Toronto. And my teaching ego state showed up for the show that night. They don't need to hear all the ins and outs of catalepsy and, you know, all these other things. It's nothing to do with an entertaining show. And so my entertainer ego state hadn't been executive. So we'll certainly get at how to get these states executive before we close this podcast, because we wanted to have a great life. And when I teach now, I've negotiated, Lori, so I have three ego states that are sort of present. One will be executive and two are in the wings. Now, remember, these are not psychological constructs. These are part of the physical structure of our brain, according to Dr. Gordon Emerson. They're part of our brain. So I have my teaching ego state. And I also have a state off to the side here. I call him the librarian. He knows everything I know about hypnosis, NLP, and personal development. In fact, he knows everything I know, period, whatever good or bad that is. And to the other side, I have an ego state. I call him the jester. The jester is an archetype. It shows up in all kinds of cultures. It's the fool in the tarot. It's the Joker in Batman. And it's a little off the wall. And it was the only ego state. It was the only archetype that could tell the king, could insult him to his face in the court. He had permission because he told the truth. Well, he's also funny. So to my other side, I've got this jester ego state. And even though I'm a British Presbyterian, he's like a Jewish comic. He's hilarious. He's fast on his feet and he's constantly looking for funny lines to say. So when I'm teaching, I now know, I can feel he's about to become executive. He's got a funny line. I don't even know what it is. I have no idea. He pops in. Is executive, says the line, we get the hilarious applause, which tells me I'm doing a great job, or they laugh. He jumps out instantly, and the librarian writes down the line, so I've got it for future use. All I can say is it works. It's just a negotiated position with the three, and it works phenomenally well.
I can hear the people listening asking, but how do you do this? And in my mind, I know at times when I've done similar things, it's almost just creating a metaphorical representation of it in my mind where I just imagine it happening. Or do you go into some kind of a trance and negotiate this? What's the actual mechanism of putting this into place?
Great, great question, Lori. First of all, the going into the metaphor with it will work with superficial ego states, the ones that are on the top floor, and some of the ones that are down in the basement of the rec room. But to get to the vated ones and the problematic ones, you need a hypnotic trance. You need that to get to them unobstructed. And then, of course, there's another thing. Are we on video or just audio?
We're on video. I don't have to release the video unless you're comfortable to do so.
Well, no, I'm comfortable with it.
We're on video.
Make sure my hair doesn't look weird or anything.
No, you look amazing.
Doing okay. So, you really need the hypnosis to get to the deeper ones. But then there's a whole other thing called introjects. And introjects are not part of the personality. They act like ego states, but they're not. And you can kick them out, but you can't kick out an ego state. It's part of your brain. And we have introjects of our parents. I have introjects of my parents when I was a little kid. And I had a really good childhood, wonderful mom and dad, born in England as they were. So raised in a British family. And I've got introjects of them. But if you have something like a car accident, you can have an introject of that. They keep playing in your head. And that's not a useful place to be. Well, I had an introject going back to when I was 12. Before I started doing hypnosis, I was 13. I got a pellet gun, a 177 caliber pellet gun for my birthday. And I was a very small, very bullied kid. I was beaten up a lot, I mean, badly so, which is why I became a freaking martial arts instructor. It don't happen no more. So anyway, as a little kid, I was roughed up, beaten up, injured, like it just horrible, horrible stuff. But I got this pellet gun for my birthday and it gave me this sense of power. And it's very, very sad looking back. We lived in an apartment building on the ground floor and I started killing crows out our window. It was a flock, a murder, as they say, a murder of crows, proper term. And I shot about three of these things and it was a horrible thing, but it gave me a sensation of power. And years later, the pain from that, as I became more integrated, began to surface. And I carried guilt many, many years for shooting those crows. I mean, terribly so. And one day my wife was going out and this stuff was trying to surface and I had introjects of the crows. And this was trying to surface. And so she went out, can't remember, I think she was taking badminton lessons or something. And I thought, I'm gonna deal with this. I set up two chairs in our kitchen. And I went into a trance and the introject of the flock of crows appeared on the chair in front of me. And I talked to them and I spoke to them from my ego state of a little boy. And I said, it made me feel powerful. I said, I am so sorry. And I started crying and the crows spoke back. Introjects will speak to you. You know what it said to me, Lori? It said, We just wanted to be your friend. We wanted you to be our friend, and you killed us. It devastated me. If I hadn't done the self-work, I wouldn't be able to talk about this now. And I apologized, and they forgave me. And you know my story. Crows and ravens, my favorite birds, have started showing up for me. We taught in England, Chris Thompson and I, in Suffolk. Just before I was to speak, a flock of jackdaws, English crows and ravens, flew in and landed on the lawn outside the window where I was teaching. People said, I've never seen them do that before. I was in Vancouver, Canada, sixth floor of the Hotel Vancouver. I heard, looked out the window, a raven had landed on my windowsill in downtown Vancouver. I went, what are you doing here? It flew away, came back with another one. I got a picture of the two of them on my windowsill. It's just incredible. I take it that they have forgiven me. And but that was an introject, and I didn't kick it out. I made friends with it. But
when I trained with you, we did our celebration dinner at a place that I think was new to you. And we all went downstairs and we're sitting there and we look on the wall. And on the wall is this like 20-foot raven. I couldn't believe it.
That was the Wickham Social. I had never been there before. They gave us a special room with our own bartender in the back. And one of you, you or Helen or someone said, look, and I looked over my shoulder and a painting of a raven on the wall. just uncanny.
Yeah.
But we carry these things, you know. Are you okay for time still?
I'm totally okay for time, yes.
Okay. I wanted to mention how much healing can come from dealing with ego states. You know, people talk about the inner child, but it goes beyond that. We don't just have an inner child. We have an inner child at different ages, and they're still there, and they need to be nurtured and encouraged and strengthened. And I've said it before, but I'll say it very quickly. 1957, April 29th, it was my fourth birthday. We're still living in England, in Chatterton, which is a suburb of Greater Manchester. And I would say, you know, if I'd stayed in England, I'd be talking like this now, because this is how my mom and dad spoke all the time. This is a very particular accent. But fortunately, I escaped it and got this Canadian accent. Except when I were home with my family, it would come back out like this. So I was my fourth birthday, and we didn't have a lot of money. My dad was ex-British Army, Royal Engineers. We went to my Aunt Sheila's for lunch on my birthday. It was my dad's sister, his younger sister. So my mom, my dad, my sister and I, my sister is 7 years older than me. And we all took the Manchester double-deck bus, and we were on the top floor, top level of the bus. And they had this wonderful lunch for me. And we had sandwiches and they had a birthday cake, first one I'd ever had. Still remember I was four, a box of Black Magic chocolates, which were a reckless luxury at that time. They were expensive. And some cardboard soldiers. They were cut out of cardboard. They were so inexpensive. And someone, I can only presume it was my mom and dad, got me a teddy bear for my birthday. I'd never had one. I can remember clearly, I sat with this bear on my knee and told him I loved him. And his name was Teddy, in a little jacket. And I drank tea and ate Black Magic chocolates. Still remember it was the marzipan one. And lunch ended, we had to go home. And it was raining because it was England. And we got back in the Manchester bus again, Chatterton bus. And we got off at the other end, we're walking up the road, umbrellas, gathered all our stuff and realized I'd left my teddy bear on the bus. And words cannot describe how devastated I was. I don't feel it anymore, but I remember that I felt terrified and grief-stricken. First time I felt grief in my life. Mm-hmm. And so scared. And my dad contacted the bus company, inquiries were made, as they say, but no sign of it. And my bear never showed up. And I buried that pain. I buried it. And it was the wrong thing to do. I didn't know any better. Well, my wife, she and I have been married, this year will be 40 years. I still call her my first wife to keep her on her toes. But it was Christmas 1986. And her birthday is Christmas Day. And so Christmas is a huge deal in our house. We were opening the presents. It was like a Christmas story where he gets the Red Rider 300-shot BB gun, which amazingly, Laurie, that was filmed two blocks from my house in Toronto at Magdar Studios. All the inside shots were done in Toronto.
Whoa.
And even the streetcars in that are Toronto. So Heather, at the end of the, you know, Christmas celebration, she said, I think there's another present there. And where? Behind the, you know, piece of furniture. I grabbed this thing. It said, to Mike from Santa Claus. Present. Rip this open. Here I am, a 33-year-old man. at the time, ripped this thing open. That was a teddy bear. She knew my story. And the instant I looked at that bear, it even had his name Teddy on his sweater. Just amazing. I just had that wounded, faded ego state become executive for the first time since I was 4 years old. And I hugged that bear with all my strength, sat on the floor in our house, and was rocked with sobs for like 5 minutes, couldn't stop sobbing. And that ego state began to heal at that moment. And I'm gonna get something.
Okay.
I thought you'd like to meet him.
Oh, yes. I feel so lucky.
So here's Teddy. And he's just a fantastic bear. Exemplary bear. And he, I'm telling you, I'm coming up 68 in a few weeks. And this bear sleeps in my bed with me every single night. And when I go to bed at night, he fits right in the pocket here, like this. And I fall asleep with that ego state, that childhood ego state executive. And I'm safe and secure. And it was one of the most wonderful healing things in my life. It really started to change me as a human being, just dealing with that. So we have these hurts, you know, we have these things. I tell hypnotists and therapists all the time when I get to teach them, psychiatrists as well. It still makes me laugh that with my grade 10 education, I've trained 6 psychiatrists. And who would have thought? But I tell them, do the self-work.
Yeah.
Do the freaking self-work. It makes the difference. We never arrive this side of eternity, but the more we can be a clear vessel, the better we're able to help other people. And that's what it's about, right?
I agree with you. And I think there's something, what I keep hearing you say is you bring an element of imagination and almost childlike creativity into it, where you have this teardrop shaped mouth, this teddy bear. You're doing
it. He's right.
You're doing it in such an imaginative way. You're looking at a chair and hallucinating a crow sitting on it.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's our unconscious mind speaks the language of imagination. And when we do it on a metaphorical level, I think it can be so much more healing than talking about it all day or all year or all decade.
You are so right. And that's why you've nailed a point here, Lori, that is the point. That's why when we are not in hypnotic states, and as right-handed people, most of the people are anyway, we're primarily using our left hemisphere to, you know, these are gross generalizations, I admit. But this is information that is sequential and linear and, you know, verbal, detail, mathematics. But when we go into trance and we activate the right hemisphere, which is largely the hemisphere of the unconscious, and the two hemispheres then begin to talk to each other through the corpus callosum, so 200 million fibers, we wake up the right hemisphere, and its language is the language of color and form and image and music and metaphor. And so, yes, instead of just dealing with this stuff in an intellectual way to get into that deep, I guess the forest of the unconscious where all these things are, that's where the healing is. I really think it is. And that's why when we, you know, we'll see this. Remember I said everything is ego state stuff. You think about it. When we do something like one of the tapping regimens like EFT or, you know, whatever, sometimes it doesn't work. Almost always does. If you do it right, I can make it work every time. Only because I've learned how over 25 years of doing it. But when it doesn't work, it's often because we don't have the vated ego state executive. So instead of having the one present that needs the healing when we're doing the tapping, we have an intellectual ego state present that talks about the problem instead.
And you were saying the key to getting the right one is to feel it.
Yes. And this is, as hypnotists, that's how the effect bridge works. The somatic bridge or the effect bridge. So somatic bridge, follow the symptom back, that nervous twitch, whatever it is, to the first time you felt that nervous twitch. Now we put that ego state in the executive. I'm just going to take one of these out and recharge it as we're speaking. Usually works. And the other thing is the effect bridge, following the emotions back, following the feelings back. When did you first feel that feeling? So first I'll have the person amplify the feelings, provided they're not too traumatic, so that they're feeling them in their body. And now that you've amplified it and can recognize the components of it, follow it back in time. When was the very first time you felt that? And by doing that, we are putting that ego state executive you know, hypnotists who deal with smoking cessation, like a good friend, Ken Guzzo, is probably the best there is in the world at that very thing. They'll all tell you that in the early days, people would phone in and make an appointment and it wouldn't work. And the reason why is the ego state that makes the appointment is the one that's a threshold, but is not necessarily the one that shows up in the office. So we have to get the one that needs the work to be executive. Otherwise, we're talking to the wrong person.
I love that. I tell people you create what you narrate. And I found when you just start talking about that time in the past when you went through that scene, you see people, you see their countenance change. You see them bring that ego state up. And I think for me personally, I don't have anything disparaging to say about talk therapy. I know there's lots of different ways to get help, but growing up in talk therapy myself, I would bring that traumatized little girl to the door of the bungalow over and over and over. And it's like, I would just dump even more negativity into that situation. It's almost like it made it worse. But when you bring that ego state to the executive and then you bring healing in, it's so powerful and effective and so fast.
It really is. It can be almost instant. And you really nailed another good point there, young woman. It's something John Grinder said. He said, we do what we're talking about and we talk about what we're doing.
Ooh.
And as we start to talk about these ego states, we will bring them executive at that time. It's a fascinating thing. To me, it's a never ending source of amazement. I dealt with a woman who would play backgammon. She's a good backgammon player. But when she'd get trapped, she'd start to feel this weird combination of frustration, being trapped, and sexual arousal at the same time. Now, it's not something from playing a board game. And so when she was playing the game, I said, when you start to feel the thing, ask yourself, how old am I right now? And she said, 10. That's what she did when she asked herself. And then it brought back a flood of memory of her older brother sexually abusing her. And that was an ego state that had become executive through playing a game when she was trapped in the game, brought back him trapping her. We are complex beings, no question about it.
Amazing. You had mentioned earlier that you were going to share with us how we can bring different ego states to the executive.
Yes, I am. Let's wait for this right-hand one to come. I just put one of my earphones back in. So we'll see. Say something so I can hear you there.
I'm just talking about ego states.
That just came on. Stay here. Yeah, I found this out by accident, and it's been a game changer for me and a lot of other people. You've trained with us, Lori, so you know I do this pretty well every training. There's a pressure point on the back of both hands from Chinese medicine. It's called the triple warmer. It ties into acupuncture, and it's between, so your listeners, or you can have video, it doesn't matter, between the ring finger and the baby finger in the channel between the metacarpal bones on the back of the hand. It's two fingertips wide. There's a channel just right there. And when you tap the triple warmer firmly, if you make affirmative statements, you will summon the right ego state to the executive. It'll show up. And what I did was I found Gordon Emerson's method. He talked about a shopping list. So I want an ego state executive that is, you know, calm, but assertive without being aggressive, whatever these things were. And hopefully the one that most matches will show up. Well, this guarantees it.
Awesome.
So adding this to it. So the person taps and they say, we get the whole class to tap. They're standing relaxed and loose and saying, I am awesome. All my resources are online. I'm powerful. I'm strong. I'm loving. I'm a caring person. I can handle this. I can handle whatever I need to because I am awesome. And this for 30, 40 seconds, always said in a positive, not, you know, I'm not afraid anymore. No, I am confident. And then setting an awesome anchor is the final key. And I recommend the tip of the thumb to the ring fingertip of the non-dominant hand. Squeeze it, look at it, and say, awesome. After doing this thing for like about 40 seconds. And what happens is you're anchoring it visually, auditorially, because you're hearing yourself say it. Awesome. And you're feeling the touch of the fingertip and the thumb. What happens is then every time you're in a situation where you notice you're in a good ego state, so you might be out with some friends and you're just having a great evening and you recognize, you get your unconscious to bring it to your attention. You go, I'm having a really good time tonight. Look at your awesome anchor, fire it again. Awesome. Hold it for 5 to 10 seconds. Put that, stack that resource on top and keep making the awesome anchor stronger and stronger. It'll burn out from use, but if you keep stacking, you're refueling it all the time. If I'm sixth row center for AC/DC, as I was, or Black Sabbath, you know, which I wasn't, I'm in a great state and I can fire that awesome anchor and put that on it too. So now when I need to get in the zone, that's how I'll do it. You know, when I used to do the college and university shows, my last university show was Western University, big university in Southern Ontario. I performed that university for 44 or 45 years in a row for Frosh Week. And I would get in the zone because there were always at least 6,000 kids in the audience. And these are 18-year-old kids. This is a guy in his 60s going to hold their attention. But they gave me a great dressing room. They were so kind to me. They wanted me to keep doing the gig. They would send a chauffeur-driven limousine to Toronto for me, 2.5 hours away, take me to the backstage. I would do my show. The limo would bring me back to my house. I wouldn't even have to stay overnight. There we are. Just wonderful. But this is how I would get in the zone. I'd be in my dressing room and I am in the zone. I'm going to blow them away. I am energy personified. And bang, I would hit the stage like AC/DC. And it was a wonderful thing. This will serve very well. When you add the awesome anchor, you've got a shortcut. And when you've made the awesome anchor strong, when you need to get in the zone, you can do it in 5 or 10 seconds and be ready for whatever's coming up.
I love that. So for anyone listening who's dealing with that inner critic or that imposter monster who's telling you these negative things about your ability to follow your dream and make a difference in the world, I find that one of the best ways to choose the ego state that's best for this adventure is to ask yourself, how do I want to feel? Or even how do I want to show up in the world? And then you can do the exercise Mike just taught you and just say the things that that person would say if that person was yes. that, or that ego state would say if they were in the executive, and it's
yes.
like calling them up there.
It is. And you're using the as if frame, you know, what would you say if you were that person? You know, I am resourceful. I am powerful. These are strong identity statements, and identity statements are going to affect our capabilities, our beliefs, our behaviors, and our surrounding environment as well. And it's a wonderful thing because the one out of the 150 that most matches that will show up, and it'll be amazing. We had a guy in Toronto from Yorkshire, England, little man, as physically little, but he was an amazing presenter, just an awesome presenter. And I grew to really like him a lot. We became friends and his name was Richard. He wouldn't mind me saying this. We got him on video with this. And he came up to the front of the class. Because sometimes he'd go to present in a, you know, a management session or, you know, a keynote or something. Usually it would be amazing. He'd hit it out of the park. Sometimes he'd be nervous and it wouldn't go well. And he didn't know why. He said it had nothing to do with the number of people or anything. So I pranced him out and asked for the ego state. That does a great job to become executive and say, I'm here when you're here. It took about 40 seconds. And this powerful voice said, I'm here. I was like, whoa. Asked it its name. Its name was Lionheart. Now you think about it. Richard the Lionheart was one of the kings of England.
Yeah.
And it fit perfectly. And he would go out there and present and just be on fire and amazing and congruent. And I said, that's great, Lionheart. Would you move aside? And now I'd like to speak to the part of you that becomes executive when you don't enjoy speaking. And 40 seconds later, this little voice said, I'm here. And its name was Plant. Like a little plant that could be trampled on. It was delicate. And somehow it had gotten trapped and somehow it wound up being the one presenting. And so we just negotiated. I said, Plant, I know you don't like doing this. How would it be with you if Lionheart takes over every single keynote from now on? I'd like that. Lionheart, will you do that? Yes, I'll do that. I'll take care of it. Okay, I want you two to hug each other. You got to seal the deal or shake hands or something. That's it. That's the whole thing. Took about 7 minutes. And now he's got the right ego state executive. And Plant can do something else, can do something delicate and gentle. It doesn't have to be executive in a scary room full of people.
I love this so much. I'm getting so many ideas for how I'm going to incorporate this in my groups. Wonderful. And with myself. Yeah. Mike, how are you doing on time? Do you have a few more minutes?
I'm fine.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm fine. How long? I'll just keep plugging these earphones back in and keep giving them a charge.
Okay. I'll wait.
That's good. We're good.
Okay. You called me a few weeks ago and it was so interesting because I was sitting in my office, minding my own business. And I get a, I never answer my phone. I don't even give people my phone number in my business, but I saw that it was Mike Mandel and I thought, I'm taking this call. And when I got off the call, I thought that was so crazy because you spoke so like you just went right to the heart of the problem that I had been trying to guide someone else through earlier in the day, which is this idea of, you know, when people have finished a training with Mike Mandel and they have that certification, they know you teach that you need to show up with prestige. You need to show up with confidence and congruence. And it can be so scary to do that when you don't have a lot of sessions under your belt. And so people are so afraid of positioning themselves as the expert. And you said something to me about this idea of being an expert. And I wonder, I hate to put you on the spot, but I know you will rise to the occasion. Will you talk about what you said to me on the phone that day?
Well, if you can remind me.
Yes, so, you were talking about how you used to come in on forensic cases and you
Does that
jog your memory enough? Okay.
Yeah, it does. It does. It's I've been blessed to work on a lot of major crimes. Blessed is maybe a strange word for it, but it's been a remarkable privilege being consulted on 3 murder cases, which is highly unusual, but I've never had to give evidence in court, which is how it should be for a forensic hypnotist. We should enable them to find hard evidence that goes to court that we never have to give any evidence or testimony at all. But I said, despite that, I was never concerned about it because in the courtroom, there's a definition of what an expert is. And an expert is someone who knows more about the subject than the judge and the jury. And that's it. So anybody doing hypnosis, if the judge and jury are not doing hypnosis, you're an expert. You know more about it than they do. And I think we need to recognize that people know more about stuff than they realize, you know? And as we do the self-work, we're more able to sort of nail that point that's needed at that time. You know, that's why I tell my students always, don't go in with a plan. Because if you go in with a plan, we're going to attempt to replicate what happened with the last case. Oh, I did this timeline thing and that worked really well. So I'm going to do that again because it's another snake phobia. Well, not necessarily. There might be a whole other set of issues here. But the more we do the self-work, the more we're liable to, the more we're able to just let our unconscious mind give that answer. And sometimes the tiniest things, the most ridiculous things, can have the most profound effects. It still freaks me out. Years ago, I dealt with a man east of Toronto who had fake heart attacks. He thought he was having real heart attacks. He was in his mid-20s, married with a kid, nice wife, nice guy, worked for GM. There was a GM plant there at the time. And he'd think he was having a heart attack. He'd have all the symptoms, pain down his arm, shortness of breath. They call EMS. The ambulance would take him away. He'd be going, goodbye forever. I think he's dying. Get to the hospital. There'd be nothing wrong with him. And he'd had 3 or 4 of these. Now, I had figured, okay, I'm going to build resource states. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. But this was early in my therapeutic days, in the early 90s. Instead, I sat down and he told me about this. And I just had this insight. I said, you ever see one of those little trains, wind-up train on a track, goes in a circle? He said, yeah, it's funny you should say that. We had one around the Christmas tree when I was a kid. I said, that's interesting. Just imagine. Like when you think of this heart attack thing, tell me about it. He said, well, I see myself in this and I see myself having heart surgery. And he's showing me in front of himself in the air where this is. And I said, I want you to imagine one of those train tracks is around you, just below eye level, the little trains there. And I want you to put all those pictures of the heart attack on this. Now I'm shifting into hypnotic language and building rapport and slowing down and so on. I'm just going to give that train a little tap so it goes around behind you and stops. And his face flushed and he went, well, that's certainly different. That was it. That was the whole therapy. And he never had a pseudo heart attack again. He was just carrying these images around in front of him all the time. So it worked with something he knew, this little train thing, put it behind him, and that was it. So again, we're working with the metaphor. We change the metaphor, you know, a picture in front of you on a train track, we change it, move it, and everything changes.
I love that so much. And one of the most important things that I have learned from you is the idea of not going into a session with a plan. And I think something that has enabled me to do that is I will sometimes go into the session. When I very first started, I would go into the session as Mike Mandel. And I remember when I did my first smoking cessation, I was so scared and I had so many limiting beliefs about helping someone stop smoking. And I went to the woman's house and it was one of my old hairstyling clients. And as I was walking up to her door, I was thinking about you, Mike, and how you sometimes refer to yourself as a magician or a wizard. And as I was walking up to the door, I literally pushed up my wizard sleeves. Yeah. I tipped my wizard hat and I walked in there as a wizard. And I will tell you, that woman, even though I was terrified, I walked in with that confidence. And I think if we as therapists get in the right ego state, when we step in there, yeah, we are going to know, we can trust ourselves to know how to guide that client as they're in the so-called chair with us.
That is bang on. That is bang on accurate. And I love the putting on the wizard. I mean, that's a fantastic thing. If you think about it too, if we have a plan when we go in, we have this big box of tools. We're basically saying, no matter what happens, this is the tool I'm using. I'd rather have them all available and choose the right one, whether it's a micrometer or a hammer or a screwdriver or whatever.
And you mentioned the librarian earlier. There is a part of us. If you've said in Mike's teachings and Freddie's, you know, I've had so many amazing trainers here, and you all know I highly recommend Mike. I highly recommend Freddie. We won't get into that, but there is a part of you that is always taking in this information and that has it at your, that's a resource that is available to you. And when you get in that right ego state and you let the librarian or the student or the scholar know, okay, I want you to hand me the right tool at the right time, you can trust that it will do so.
Yes, that's correct. And if you're listeners, Lori, want to experiment with some self-hypnosis, they can easily check out my journey to the castle by just going to mikemandelhypnosis.com/castle, download it for free and use it for whatever purpose they want, for building confidence, for sleeping better, whatever. Just don't use it at bedtime. It's like power napping before you go to bed. Not a good move.
I highly, highly recommend that anyone listening do that. I will have the resources linked below this show. For anyone who's listening and doesn't have access to those resources, I highly urge you also to get on YouTube and search Mike Mandel Fred Talk, because he does what I consider a masterclass on ego states for Freddie Jacquin. And then if you are inside Mike Mandel Hypnosis Academy, which I also highly, highly recommend, Mike, you and Chris just did a training on ego states, did you not?
Yes, we did something for our students. They all run it together in my head after a while.
I'm sure.
Because it's sort of, I don't know, Chris keeps me going, keeps me moving. I'm so glad you mentioned Freddie, though. He's one of my best friends in the world. He's a phenomenal hypnotist, just incredible. He fixed my sleep paralysis while we were coming from Toronto Airport in the car with him and Anthony in the backseat, Chris's Tesla, Chris driving. And I was telling him how I had the sleep paralysis that was really horrifying. I couldn't move. And and he just talked to me. I say to this day, I can't remember anything he said, but I do remember him saying, I don't think you're going to have to worry about that anymore. That was it. And I just went, I received that. That was it. It's over.
Phenomenal. Yeah, he's brilliant. I'm so grateful to know both of you. It's just, you have both changed my life in profound ways. Before we can, may I start one more subject before we jump
off? Of course you
can. Okay, you had mentioned graphology and graphotherapy at the start of this call, talking about the T-bar. My handwriting has completely changed since I went through your graphology course. It was just,
I forgot you did that. Okay.
Yeah, I did that early on. Excellent. When you had made it available inside MMHA, I believe. I think I might've even gotten the beginning. And then you also taught it when I was in Toronto with you. And it has transformed so many things for me. And I've noticed, Mike, when I'm in a certain mood, my handwriting is so different. I can tell a lot about the ego state I have in the executive by my handwriting. So could you talk to people who are listening about things that they can do inside their handwriting that might increase their confidence and start to silence that imposter monster?
Absolutely. There's some key things you can do. Realize graphology, scientific graphology, and there's a number of types out there, but a lot of them are just made up by the author of the book. Real graphology is a subset of psychology. And in Europe, it's mainstream. You can study at the Sorbonne in Paris or in University of Heidelberg. And it's used for, marriage counseling and job applicants and all sorts of things. And the reason it's a science is it's based on large numbers. So you know, you look at the writing of 500 high achievers, what are the common elements? You look at the writing of, you know, people suffering from grief or people who are alcoholics, and what are the common elements? And then you begin to make a prediction based on the traits you find that these are going to show up repeatedly in other types of handwriting. And of course it's worked. It's been around for quite a long time, but there's things you can do that are graphotherapeutic, meaning it is not your hand that writes, it's your prefrontal cortex, and it's a complex neuromuscular function down to fine motor skills. When our personalities change, our handwriting will change as well. But having said that, they're in a constant psychodynamic loop with each other, the hand and the brain. Consequently, when one changes the handwriting intentionally, it sends a signal back to the brain and the personality begins to change as well. And it can work in as little as 28 days. This is so startling that when I was in England on tour years ago, I saw the handwriting of Samuel Johnson, Lewis Carroll, you know, Shakespeare, some of the greats at the British Museum. I got to see their original writing. And they invariably had a trait called the literary D or the delta D, which is found in the writing of great writers. It's an indication of writing ability and way with words. And I liked it so much, I put it in my handwriting and forgot about it. Totally forgot. 3 months later, there was a bookstore in Toronto called World's Biggest Bookstore, because it was at the time, it was huge and doesn't exist anymore. But I went there with the intention of picking up a couple of hypnosis books for a course I was teaching at University of Toronto. I came back without the books, but about four hardcover poetry books, you know, Byron, Keats, Shelley. My wife said, "What's with all the poetry books?" I said, "I get it." She said, "What do you mean you get it?" I said, "I opened this. I read She Walks in Beauty of the Night with Cloudless Climbs and Starry Skies. I said, this hit me. I get it for the first time in my life." She said, "You idiot. You put the literary D in your writing months ago and forgot." That's right. Astounding. But there's things you can put in your writing that will help you with your confidence, and they're very easy to do. One of them is underline your signature always with a single left to right underscore that doesn't go through the body of the letters. It can go through the descenders like the D, the small letter G and the Y, but not through the body of the signature. Single left to right strong underscore builds in self-reliance, which is a leadership trait, the ability to go it alone. Second one is this. This is very difficult to do. It will fight back. It takes work, but it's worth it. All the crossbars of the small letter T, put them higher up the stem. They show how high we set our goals in life. If they're low, even with the middle letters like A and M and N, the person is doubting their own ability. We push them high, make them long, and make them heavy pressure as well, even slightly slanted up. This builds in enthusiasm, endurance of will, high goals, self-esteem, and optimism as well. So high up the stem, long and slightly slanted upward, and make them left to right always, not you know, directing willpower again. So this has a phenomenal effect. It took me a long time to get that happening. And all you've got to do is get a journal and practice 5 minutes a day, yeah, and just build these new traits in. And the third one is a great one. The lower loops on letters like G and Y, where you have a descender going down into the unconscious, coming back as a loop, make sure when it comes back that it crosses the baseline, which is the line the writing is sitting on. It's going down into the unconscious for ideas and bringing them back. Make your lower loops large and well-formed. Bring in variety. My lower loops were incomplete. They were just like a cup. I studied with my first graphology teacher in 1992, Elaine Cheryl, best graphologist in Canada. She became a friend. And she said, "What I'm doing," she said, "my brain is going into the unconscious for ideas, is not bringing them back out."
Oh.
Everything below the baseline is unconscious. She said, "Complete those loops." I did. I became a creative freaking monster. Wrote a short story, won a prize. Toronto Star published it. My first short story. Became a wine writer and a wine judge. I mean, just insane. Became an opera critic. Just took on all these things. My brain went, "Thank you." Down into the unconscious for ideas. So make your lower loops large, well-formed, and cross the baseline, and you'll get so much more variety and interesting ideas coming to the surface, and creativity will soar. Combine that with underlining the signature and make the T-bars nice and high, and you are off to the metaphorical races.
It makes such a big difference. So the T-bars is one of the first things I changed, and I still think about you because all my T's look like capital T's. And I sometimes wonder how much of me moving forward in my business is just because Mike helped me change my T-bars.
You'll never know. And it's astounding, isn't it? It helps with business. It absolutely does. And give ourselves the advantage. I say graphic therapy is the easiest therapy you can do. It takes about a month for it to start working into the personality. And again, we say not to cross through the name. If you cross through the name, you're beating up on yourself, especially if you cross through the surname, you're beating up on your family. You know, and so, my friend Paul in England was my driver from Thames Valley Police, 6'7", 300 pounds, enormous cop. And he passed me his warrant card, which is their equivalent of their badge. And he said, "What does my writing say?" And he's driving, and just his signature was on it. And it's Paul, last name Giles. And he, Paul was normal. Giles was, wrote about 500 times. I said, "Any issues between you and your father?" He goes, "Only every single day for the last 30 years." Just, it's in the writing, you know?
Yeah, it really is. Sometimes I am almost embarrassed. I want to say, "You should put that away. I know way too much about you now."
I know, it's terrible, isn't it? It's if people knew what their writing revealed, they'd never let a graphologist look at it. And the way I got my chops was I did a lecture, a University College lecture, only a decade ago. And it was called, "Are You Dating a Psychopath?" And I would lecture on these different traits. And then the kids would line up and they'd all write samples. And I'd do 60 different analyses, like just 2 minutes each one, bang, 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 bang. And that gave me the chops to be able to do it really fast. But oh my goodness, if people knew, if they only knew what they're putting out there in the paper in front of them.
Yeah, it's amazing. Real quick, this is kind of just for my gratification. Do you know who William Hewitt is?
No, who's that?
He wrote some books called, one is called Beyond Hypnosis, and there's some real woo-woo stuff, but he has you write down, he instructs people on graphotherapy, and he gives all the cues you just gave about the T-bar underlining your name, but he says, make sure that you dot your letters, like your J's and your I's, with a tiny little circle. And I wanted to see what you think about that, because I feel like that almost goes against something I learned from you.
No, I don't agree at all. That's a liability. That's a liability. It's called a spotlight. And when you put a little circle, it's the need to be a little bit special.
Okay.
And it can actually be a problem. I mean, some of them do a star, some do a heart, but a little circle is a spotlight, and it's a need to get attention, and it's not a strength. You'll often see it combined with back to self strokes on final. So you write your word, whatever, it doesn't have to be your name, and then comes back and points back itself. And that's a desperate need for attention.
Okay.
And we'll see the two together a lot of the time. No circles.
This has been so awesome. Is there anything?
Yes, it has.
Is there anything that I haven't asked that you feel is important to share before we say goodbye?
Just this. You know, we've got near magical powers with these things. Don't put any limits on it. Richard Bandler said, I heard him only speak once, but he said, don't put limits on what you're able to do, because you're creating them artificially. He said, don't worry, there are limits there, and you'll run into them soon enough. If you pretend there aren't any, that'll be one of the strongest things you can possibly do, because you'll go way beyond. You know, people, you say aim for the moon, you just might hit it. Yes. My mentor, Derek Balmer, who's since passed away, he did a remarkable thing, and it's a gift. And anyone who's teaching other people, give this some thought. He would close a lot of loops in the class. We would get closure on things and understand things, but he set up other loops that didn't close for weeks, even months afterwards. And it's a way of keeping us learning. I remember he died in October 2000. So he's been dead for over 20 years. And sometimes I'm still to this day having loops closed because of some seed he planted in my head 20 years ago. Wow. So realize we are having a profound effect on other people. And let's ensure that the seeds that we are planting are not weeds.
I'm so grateful you've listened all the way to the end. What is one tiny action step you'll take now based on an aha moment you got during the podcast? Maybe that life-changing action step is to come accept the gift I have for you at theimpostermonster.com. Head there right now to get your powerful hypnosis audio, The Answer Room. That lets you make important decisions and get crystal clear about your next step forward on this path of purpose in your one great and precious life.